could wish to fight," she said softly. "But I don't. I don't even want to win any longer. There's one change that I don't seem to have the strength to make. You see, I'd never expected anything like my marriage to Jim. Then when it happened, I thought that life was much more wonderful than I'd expected. And now to get used to the idea that life and people are much more horrible than anything I'd imagined, and that my marriage was not a glorious miracle, but some unspeakable kind of evil which I'm still afraid to learn fully. That is what I can't force myself to take. I can't get past it." She glanced up suddenly. "Dagny, how did you do it? How did you manage to remain unmangled?"
"By holding to just one rule."
"Which?"
"To place nothing, nothing, above the verdict of my own mind."
"You've taken some terrible beatings, maybe worse than I did, worse than any of us. What held you through it?"
"The knowledge that my life is the highest of values, too high to give up without a fight." She saw a look of astonishment, of incredulous recognition on Cheryl's face, as if the girl were struggling to recapture some sensation across a span of years.
"Dagny?"
Her voice was a whisper.
That's what I felt when I was a child. That's what I seem to remember most about myself. That kind of feeling.
And I never lost it. It's there. It's always been there. But as I grew up, I thought it was something that I must hide. I never had any name for it. But just now, when you said it, it struck me that that's what it was. Dagny, to feel that way about your own life? Is that good?
Cheryl, listen to me carefully. That feeling, with everything which it requires and implies, is the highest, noblest, and only good on earth.
The reason I ask is because I wouldn't have dared to think that. Somehow people always made me feel as if they thought it was a sin, as if that were the thing in me which they resented and wanted to destroy.
It's true, some people do want to destroy it. And when you learn to understand their motive, you'll know the darkest, ugliest, and only evil in the world. But you'll be safely out of its reach. Cheryl's smile was like a feeble flicker, struggling to retain its hold upon a few drops of fuel, to catch them, to flare up.
"It's the first time in months," she whispered, "that I felt as if there's still a chance."
She saw Dagny's eyes watching her with attentive concern, and she added,
"I'll be all right. Let me get used to it, to you, to all the things you said. I think I'll come to believe it, to believe that it's real, and that Jim doesn't matter."
She rose to her feet as if trying to retain the moment of assurance. Prompted by a sudden causeless certainty, Dagny said sharply, "Cheryl, I don't want you to go home tonight."
"Oh, no, I'm all right. I'm not afraid that way, not of going home."
"Didn't something happen there tonight?"
"No, not really, nothing worse than usual. It was just that I began to see things a little more clearly, that was all. I'm all right. I have to think harder than I ever did before. And then I'll decide what I must do." "May I?"
She hesitated.
"Yes?" "May I come back to talk to you again?"
"Of course."
"Thank you. I'm very grateful to you."
"Will you promise me that you'll come back?"
"I promise."
Dagny saw her walking off down the hall toward the elevator, saw the slump of her shoulders, then the effort that lifted them, saw the slender figure that seemed to sway, then marshal all of its strength to remain erect. She looked like a plant with a broken stem, still held together by a single fiber, struggling to heal the breach, which one more gust of wind would finish. Through the open door of his study, James Taggart had seen Cheryl cross the anteroom and walk out of the apartment. He had slammed his door and slumped down on the davenport, with patches of spilled champagne still soaking the cloth of his trousers, as if his own discomfort were a revenge upon his wife and upon a universe that would not provide him with the celebration he had wanted. After a while, he leaped to his feet, tore off his coat, and threw it across the room. He reached for a cigarette, but snapped it in half and flung it at a painting over the fireplace. He noticed a vase of Venetian glass, a museum piece, centuries old, with an intricate system of blue and gold arteries twisting through its transparent body. He seized it and flung it at the wall. It burst into a rain of glass as thin as a shattered light bulb. He had bought that vase for the satisfaction of thinking of all the connoisseurs who could not afford it. Now he experienced the satisfaction of a revenge upon the centuries which had prized it, and the satisfaction of thinking that there were millions of desperate families, any one of whom could have lived for a year on the price of that vase. He kicked off his shoes and fell back on the davenport, letting his stocking feet dangle in midair. The sound of the doorbell startled him. It seemed to match his mood. It was the kind of brusque, demanding, impatient snap of sound he would have produced if he were now jabbing his finger at someone's doorbell. He listened to the butler's steps, promising himself the pleasure of refusing admittance to whoever was seeking it. In a moment he heard the knock at his door, and the butler entered to announce, "Mrs. Reardon to see you, sir." "What? Oh. Well, have her come in." He swung his feet down to the floor, but made no other concession, and waited with half a smile of alerted curiosity, choosing not to rise until a moment after Lillian had entered the room. She wore a wine-colored dinner gown, an imitation of an Empire traveling suit, with a miniature double-breasted jacket gripping her high waistline over the long sweep of the skirt, and a small hat clinging to one ear, with a feather sweeping down to curl under her chin. She entered with a brusque, unrhythmical motion, the train of her dress and the feather of her hat swirling, then flapping against her legs and throat, like pennants, signaling nervousness. "Lillian, my dear, am I to be flattered, delighted, or just plain flabbergasted?" "Oh, don't make a fuss about it. I had to see you, and it had to be immediately, that's all." The impatient tone, the peremptory movement with which she sat down, were a confession of weakness. By the rules of their unwritten language, one did not assume a demanding manner unless one were seeking a favor and had no value or threat to barter. "Why didn't you stay at the Gonzales reception?" she asked, her casual smile failing to hide the tone of irritation. "I dropped in on them after dinner just to catch hold of you, but they said you hadn't been feeling well and had gone home." He crossed the room and picked up a cigarette for the pleasure of padding in his stocking feet, past the formal elegance of her costume. "I was bored," he answered. "I can't stand them," she said with a little shudder. He glanced at her in astonishment. The word sounded involuntary and sincere. "I can't stand Señor Gonzales and that whore he's got himself for a wife. It's disgusting that they've become so fashionable, they and their parties. I don't feel like going anywhere any longer. It's not the same style anymore, not the same spirit. I haven't run into Balfe Eubank for months, or Dr. Pritchett, or any of the boys, and all those new faces that look like butcher's assistants. After all, our crowd were gentlemen." "Yeah," he said reflectively. "Yeah, there's some funny kind of difference. It's like on the railroad, too. I could get along with Clem Weatherby, he was civilized, but Cuffy Meggs, that's something else again, that's..." He stopped abruptly. "It's perfectly preposterous," she said, in the tone of a challenge to the space at large. "They can't get away with it." She did not explain who or with what. He knew what she meant. Through a moment of silence, they looked as if they were clinging to each other for reassurance. In the next moment, he was thinking with pleasurable amusement that Lillian was beginning to show her age. The deep burgundy color of her gown was unbecoming. It seemed to draw a purplish tinge out of her skin, a tinge that gathered like twilight in the small gullies of her face, softening her flesh to a texture of tired slackness, changing her look of bright mockery into a look of stale malice. He saw her studying him, smiling and saying crisply, with the smile as license for insult, "You are unwell, aren't you, Jim? You look like a disorganized stable boy." He chuckled. "I can afford it." "I know it, darling. You're one of the most powerful men in New York City," she added. "It's a good joke on New York City."
"It is."
"I concede that you're in a position to do anything. That's why I had to see you." She added a small grunt-like sound of amusement to dilute her statement's frankness.
"Good," he said,
his voice comfortable and non-committal. "I had to come here because I thought it best in this particular matter.
not to be seen together in public.
That is always wise.
I seem to remember having been useful to you in the past.
In the past? Yes.
I'm sure that I can count on you.
Of course. Only isn't that an old-fashioned, unphilosophical remark? How can we ever be sure of anything?
Jim?
She snapped suddenly.
You've got to help me.
My dear, I'm at your disposal. I'll do anything to help you, he answered, the rules of their language requiring that any open statement be answered by a blatant lie. Lillian was slipping, he thought, and he experienced the pleasure of dealing with an inadequate adversary. She was neglecting, he noted, even the perfection of her particular trademark, her grooming. A few strands were escaping from the drilled waves of her hair. Her nails matching her gown were the deep shade of coagulated blood, which made it easy to notice the chipped polish at their tips. And against the broad, smooth, creamy expanse of her skin in the low, square cut of her gown, he observed the tiny glitter of a safety pin holding the strap of her slip.
"You've got to prevent it,"
she said in the belligerent tone of a plea disguised as a command.
"You've got to stop it."
"Really? What?"
"My divorce."
"Oh." His features dropped into sudden earnestness.
"You know that he's going to divorce me, don't you?"
"I've heard some rumors about it."
"It's set for next month, and when I say set, that's just what I mean. Oh, it's cost him plenty, but he's bought the judge, the clerks, the bailiffs, their backers' backers, a few legislators, half a dozen administrators. He's bought the whole legal process like a private thoroughfare, and there's no single crossroad left for me to squeeze through to stop it."
"I see."
"You know, of course, what made him start divorce proceedings?"
"I can guess."
"And I did it as a favor to you."
Her voice was growing anxiously shrill.
"I told you about your sister, in order to let you get that gift certificate for your friends, which
I swear I don't know who let it out," he cried hastily. "Only a very few at the top knew that you'd been our informer, and I'm sure nobody would dare mention—"
"Oh, I'm sure nobody did. He'd have the brains to guess it, wouldn't he?"
"Yes, I suppose so." "Well, then you knew that you were taking a chance."
"I didn't think he'd go that far. I didn't think he'd ever divorce me. I didn't—"
He chuckled suddenly with a glance of astonishing perceptiveness. "You didn't think that guilt is a rope that wears thin, did you, Lillian?" She looked at him startled, then answered stonily,
"I don't think it does."
"It does, my dear, for men such as your husband."
"I don't want him to divorce me."
It was a sudden scream.
"I don't want to let him go free. I won't permit it. I won't let the whole of my life be a total failure."
She stopped abruptly, as if she had admitted too much. He was chuckling softly, nodding his head with a slow movement that had an air of intelligence, almost of dignity, by signifying a complete understanding.
"I mean, after all, he's my husband," she said defensively.
"Yes, Lillian, yes, I know."
"Do you know what he's planning? He's going to get the decree, and he's going to cut me off without a penny. No settlement, no alimony, nothing. He's going to have the last word, don't you see? If he gets away with it, then the gift certificate was no victory for me at all."
"Yes, my dear, I see."
"And besides, it's preposterous that I should have to think of it. But what am I going to live on? The little money I had of my own is worth nothing nowadays. It's mainly stock in factories of my father's time that have closed long ago. What am I going to do?"
"But, Lillian," he said softly, "I thought you had no concern for money or for any material rewards."
"You don't understand. I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about poverty. Real, stinking, hall-bedroom poverty. That's out of bounds for any civilized person. I, too, have to worry about food and rent?"
He was watching her with a faint smile. For once, his soft, aging face seemed tightened into a look of wisdom. He was discovering the pleasure of full perception in a reality which he could permit himself to perceive.
"Jim, you've got to help me. My lawyer is powerless. I've spent the little I had on him and on his investigators, friends and fixers. But all they could do for me was find out that they can do nothing. My lawyer gave me his final report this afternoon. He told me bluntly that I haven't a chance. I don't seem to know anyone who can help against a setup of this kind. I'd counted on Bertram Scudder, but, well, you know what happened to Bertram. And that, too, was because I'd tried to help you. You pulled yourself out of that one, Jim. You're the only person who can pull me out now. You've got your gopher hole pipeline straight up to the top. You can reach the big boys. Slip a word to your friends to slip a word to their friends. One word from Wesley would do it. Have them order that divorce decree to be refused. Just have it refused.
He shook his head slowly, almost compassionately, like a tired professional at an overzealous amateur. It can't be done, Lillian, he said firmly. I'd like to do it, for the same reasons as yours, and I think you know it. But whatever power I have is not enough in this case. She was looking at him, her eyes dark, with an odd, lifeless stillness. When she spoke, the motion of her lips was twisted by so evil a contempt that he did not dare identify it beyond knowing that it embraced them both. She said, I know that you'd like to do it. He felt no desire to pretend. Oddly, for the first time, for this one chance, truth seemed much more pleasurable. Truth, for once, serving his particular kind of enjoyment. I think you know that it can't be done, he said. Nobody does favors nowadays if there's nothing to gain in return, and the stakes are getting higher and higher. The gopher holes, as you call them, are so complex, so twisted and intertwisted, that everybody has something on everybody else, and nobody dares move because he can't tell who'll crack which way or when. So he'll move only when he has to, when the stakes are life or death, and that's practically the only kind of stakes we're playing for now. Well, what's your private life to any of those boys? That you'd like to hold your husband? What's in it for them, one way or another? And my personal stock in trade? Well, there's nothing I could offer them at the moment in exchange for trying to blast a whole court clique out of a highly profitable deal. Besides, right now, the top boys wouldn't do it at any price. They have to be mighty careful of your husband. He's the man who's safe from them right now, ever since that radio broadcast of my sister's. You asked me to force her to speak on that broadcast. I know, Lillian. We lost both of us that time. And we lose both of us now.
Yes, she said,
with the same darkness of contempt in her eyes.
Both of us.
It was the contempt that pleased him. It was the strange, heedless, unfamiliar pleasure of knowing that this woman saw him as he was, yet remained held by his presence, remained and leaned back in her chair, as if declaring her bondage.
You're a wonderful person, Jim, she said.
It had the sound of damnation, yet it was a tribute, and she meant it as such. And his pleasure came from the knowledge that they were in a realm where damnation was value. You know, he said suddenly, you're wrong about those butcher's assistants like Gonzales. They have their uses. Have you ever liked Francisco D'Anconia?
I can't stand him.
Well, do you know the real purpose of that cocktail-swilling occasion staged by Senor Gonzales tonight? It was to celebrate the agreement to nationalize D'Anconia Copper in about a month. She looked at him for a moment, the corners of her lips lifting slowly into a smile.
He was your friend, wasn't he?
Her voice had a tone he had never earned before, the tone of an emotion which he had drawn from people only by fraud, but which now, for the first time, was granted with full awareness to the real, the actual nature of his deed. A tone of admiration. Suddenly he knew that this was the goal of his restless hours. This was the pleasure he had despaired of finding. This was the celebration he had wanted. Let's have a drink, Lil, he said. Pouring the liquor, he glanced at her across the room as she lay stretched limply in her chair. Let him get his divorce, he said. He won't have the last word. They will. The butcher's assistants. Senor Gonzales and Cuffy Meggs. She did not answer. When he approached, she took the glass from him with a sloppily indifferent sweep of her hand. She drank not in the manner of a social gesture, but like a lonely drinker in a saloon, for the physical sake of the liquor. He sat down on the arm of the davenport improperly close to her, and sipped his drink, watching her face. After a while he asked, "What does he think of me?" The question did not seem to astonish her.
He thinks you're a fool, she answered. He thinks life's too short to notice your existence.
He'd notice it if... He stopped.
If you bashed him over the head with a club? I'm not too sure. He'd merely blame himself for not having moved out of the club's reach. Still, that would be your only chance.
She shifted her body, sliding lower in the armchair, stomach forward, as if relaxation were ugliness. As if she were granting him the kind of intimacy that required no poise and no respect.
"That was the first thing I noticed about him," she said. "When I met him for the first time, that he was not afraid. He looked as if he felt certain that there was nothing any of us could do to him. So certain that he didn't even know the issue or the nature of what he felt."
"How long since you saw him last?"
3 months. "I haven't seen him since." "Since the gift certificate.
I saw him at an industrial meeting 2 weeks ago. He still looks that way, only more so. Now he looks as if he knows it." He added, "You have failed, Lillian."
She did not answer. She pushed her hat off with the back of her hand. It rolled down to the carpet, its feather curling like a question mark. "I remember the first time I saw his Mills," she said. "His Mills. You can't imagine what he felt about them. You wouldn't know the kind of intellectual arrogance it takes to feel as if anything pertaining to him, anything he touched, were made sacred by the touch. His Mills, his metal, his money, his bed, his wife." She glanced up at him, a small flicker piercing the lethargic emptiness of her eyes. "He never noticed your existence." "He did notice mine. I'm still Mrs. Reardon. At least for another month."
"Yes," he said, looking down at her, with a sudden new interest.
"Mrs. Reardon," she chuckled. "You wouldn't know what that meant to him. No feudal lord ever felt or demanded such reverence for the title of his wife, or held it as such a symbol of honor, of his unbending, untouchable, inviolate, stainless honor." She waved her hand in a vague motion, indicating the length of her sprawled body. "Caesar's wife," she chuckled. "Do you remember what she was supposed to be?" "No, you wouldn't. She was supposed to be above reproach."
He was staring down at her with the heavy, blind stare of impotent hatred, a hatred of which she was the sudden symbol, not the object. "He didn't like it when his medal was thrown into common public use for any chance passerby to make, did he?"
"No, he didn't."
His words were blurring a little, as if weighted with drops of the liquor he had swallowed. "Don't tell me that you helped us to get that gift certificate as a favor to me and that you gained nothing. I know why you did it."
"You knew it at the time."
"Sure, that's why I like you, Lillian."
His eyes kept coming back to the low cut of her gown. It was not the smooth skin that attracted his glance, not the exposed rise of her breasts, but the fraud of the safety pin beyond the edge.
"I'd like to see him beaten," he said. "I'd like to hear him scream with pain just once."
"You won't, Jimmy."
"Why does he think he's better than the rest of us? He and that sister of mine." She chuckled. He rose as if she had slapped him.
He went to the bar and poured himself another drink, not offering to refill her glass.
She was speaking into space, staring past him.
"He did notice my existence. Even though I can't lay railroad tracks for him and erect bridges to the glory of his metal, I can't build his mills. But I can destroy them. I can't produce his metal, but I can take it away from him. I can't bring men down to their knees in admiration, but I can bring them down to their knees."
"Shut up!" he screamed in terror, as if she were coming too close to that fog-bound alley which had to remain unseen.
She glanced up at his face. "You're such a coward, Jim."
"Why don't you get drunk?" he snapped, sticking his unfinished drink at her mouth as if he wanted to strike her.
Her fingers half closed limply about the glass, and she drank, spilling the liquor down her chin, her breast, and her gown.
"Oh, hell, Lillian, you're a mess," he said,
and not troubling to reach for his handkerchief, he stretched out his hand to wipe the liquor with the flat of his palm. His fingers slipped under the gown's neckline, closing over her breast, his breath catching in a sudden gulp like a hiccup. His eyelids were drawing closed, but he caught a glimpse of her face leaning back unresistingly, her mouth swollen with revulsion. When he reached for her mouth, her arms embraced him obediently, and her mouth responded, but the response was just a pressure, not a kiss. He raised his head to glance at her face. Her teeth were bared in a smile, but she was staring past him,
as if mocking some invisible presence, her smile lifeless, yet loud with malice, like the grin of a fleshless skull. He jerked her closer to stifle the sight and his own shudder. His hands were going through the automatic motions of intimacy, and she complied, but in a manner that made him feel as if the beats of her arteries under his touch were snickering giggles. They were both performing an expected routine, a routine invented by someone and imposed upon them, performing it in mockery, in hatred, in defiling parody on its inventors. He felt a sightless, heedless fury, part horror, part pleasure, the horror of committing an act he would never dare confess to anyone, the pleasure of committing it in blasphemous defiance of those to whom he would not dare confess it. He was himself. The only conscious part of his rage seemed to be screaming to him, he was at last himself. The only conscious part of his rage seemed to be screaming to him, he was at last himself. They did not speak. They knew each other's motive. Only two words were pronounced between them. Mrs. Reardon, he said. They did not look at each other when he pushed her into his bedroom and onto his bed, falling against her body as against a soft, stuffed object. Their faces had a look of secrecy, the look of partners in guilt, the furtive, smutty look of children, defiling someone's clean fence by chalking sneaky scratches intended as symbols of obscenity. Afterward, it did not disappoint him that what he had possessed was an inanimate body without resistance or response. It was not a woman that he had wanted to possess. It was not an act in celebration of life that he had wanted to perform, but an act in celebration of the triumph of impotence. Cheryl unlocked the door and slipped in quietly, almost surreptitiously, as if hoping not to be seen or to see the place which was her home. The sense of Dagny's presence, of Dagny's world, had supported her on her way back. But when she entered her own apartment, the wall seemed to swallow her again into the suffocation of a trap. The apartment was silent. A wedge of light cut across the anteroom from a door left half open. She dragged herself mechanically in the direction of her room. Then she stopped. The open band of light was the door of Jim's study, and on the illuminated strip of its carpet she saw a woman's hat with a feather stirring faintly in a draft. She took a step forward. The room was empty. She saw two glasses, one on a table, the other on the floor, and a woman's purse lying on the seat of an armchair. She stood in unreacting stupor until she heard the muffled drawl of two voices behind the door of Jim's bedroom. She could not distinguish the words, only the quality of the sounds. Jim's voice had a tone of irritation, the woman's of contempt. Then she found herself in her own room, fumbling frantically to lock her door. She had been flung here by the blind panic of escape, as if it were she who had to hide, she who had to run from the ugliness of being seen in the act of seeing them. A panic made of revulsion, of pity, of embarrassment, of that mental chastity which recoils from confronting a man with the unanswerable proof of his evil. She stood in the middle of her room, unable to grasp what action was now possible to her. Then her knees gave way, folding gently. She found herself sitting on the floor, and she stayed there, staring at the carpet, shaking. It was neither anger, nor jealousy, nor indignation, but the blank horror of dealing with the grotesquely senseless. It was the knowledge that neither their marriage, nor his love for her, nor his insistence on holding her, nor his love for that other woman, nor this gratuitous adultery had any meaning whatever, that there was no shred of sense in any of it, and no use to grope for explanations. She had always thought of evil as purposeful, as a means to some end. What she was seeing now was evil for evil's sake. She did not know how long she had sat there when she heard their steps and voices, then the sound of the front door closing. She got up with no purpose in mind, but impelled by some instinct from the past, as if acting in a vacuum where honesty was not relevant any longer, but knowing no other way to act. She met Jim in the anteroom. For a moment they looked at each other as if neither could believe the other's reality. "When did you come back?" he snapped. "How long have you been home?"
"I don't know."
He was looking at her face.
What's the matter with you?
Jim, I...
She struggled, gave up, and waved her hand toward his bedroom.
Jim, I know.
What do you know?
You were there with a woman.